Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're your shortcut to being genuinely well-informed, without all the usual information overload.
Glad to be here.
Today, we are plunging into a world that's, well, it's critical for agriculture, definitely, but often unseen and, frankly, quite dangerous.
Absolutely.
We're talking about the highly regulated practice of fumigating for burrowing vertebrate pests, our deep dive. It's built entirely on this really comprehensive study manual from the California Department of Pesticide Regulation.
That's right. The very guide that private applicators have to study and know inside out.
Exactly. And our mission today is to sort of distill this incredibly dense stuff down.
Pull out the key pieces.
Yeah, give you those surprising facts, the critical insights, the essence of what's really important here.
And what's really fascinating, I think, is that this goes way beyond just, you know, getting rid of pests.
Right.
It's about understanding these highly toxic chemicals, incredibly stringent safety rules.
Yeah, the protocols.
And that delicate balance always between protecting our food supply and, well, the environment itself.
So we'll uncover what these fumigants actually are, the extreme care you need.
You really do.
And some honestly unexpected details about managing these burrowing pests, specifically in California.
Let's do it.
Okay, so let's start with the absolute basics. When we say pesticide, what are we actually talking about?
Broadly, any substance used to control pests. It could be insects, weeds, rodents.
But today, we're zooming in on a very unique type and uniquely hazardous fumigants.
Mm-hmm. These are the ones that turn into gas, or sometimes they're applied as a gas.
And here's the really crucial kind of unsettling part. They're usually invisible.
Yep.
And often completely odorless.
That's the kicker.
Which immediately makes them especially hazardous, right? Because your senses, they just can't warn you.
Precisely. Your nose isn't going to help you here. For burrowing pests, the two main ones we see are aluminum phosphide and magnesium phosphide.
Okay.
They start as solids, you know, tablets, pellets, sometimes plates. But they only become active. They only release the dangerous stuff when they react with moisture. Just the moisture in the air or soil.
Oh.
That's when they release phosphine gas. And the reaction, it actually starts slowly, then speeds up.
That slow start seems important.
It's absolutely critical. It gives the applicator just enough time, hopefully, to get the product deep into the burrow and seal it up before too much gas escapes.
Right, before it becomes really dangerous right there.
Exactly. And it's worth noting, magnesium phosphide, it tends to be a bit more reactive.
Oh.
Yeah, which can be useful in, say, cooler or drier conditions where the aluminum phosphide might react too slowly to be effective.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, you'd think handling something this dangerous, there'd be obvious warning signs, right? But what's really unsettling, kind of counterintuitive, is that phosphine gas isn't just an invisible poison.
Mm-hmm.
It can spontaneously ignite.
Yes. Highly flammable.
I mean, just imagine working with something like that. It defies your common sense about danger.
It really does. And to try and manage that fire risk, the aluminum phosphide products, they often contain something called ammonium carbamate.
Okay, what does that do?
It releases inert gases like carbon dioxide, which helps suppress the flammability, kind of dampens it down.
Ah, it's a safety feature.
Your critical one, but importantly, magnesium phosphide products. They don't have that safeguard.
Wow. Okay. Good to know.
And as if that wasn't enough, phosphine gas is also corrosive.
Corrosive? To what?
To materials like copper. So think about electrical wiring, maybe plumbing, any copper components nearby. They could be damaged.
That adds another layer of complexity.
It certainly does. And this brings us back to a major misconception. The smell.
Right. You mentioned odorless, but some people say they can smell it.
Yeah, you hear that sometimes, a garlic-like smell. That usually comes from impurities or contaminants in the product, not the phosphine itself.
So pure phosphine.
Pure phosphine gas is odorless, period, which means relying on your nose as some kind of warning signal. It's absolutely not reliable. It's dangerous thinking.
So that raises the critical question then. If you can't smell it, how on earth do you know if it's there? How do you know if the levels are safe?
There's only one way. Specific calibrated monitoring devices, gas detectors designed for phosphine.
No guesswork.
Zero guesswork. Your life or someone else's literally depends on getting accurate readings from those devices, not from sniffing the air.
Okay. So, exposure. How does it usually happen with this invisible threat?
By far, the most common and hazardous route is breathing it in. respiratory inhalation.
Makes sense.
The highest risk times for the handlers, the applicators, are really predictable moments when they first open the sealed container.
Right, that initial release.
During the actual application process, getting it into the burrows.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, when they're handling or disposing of the leftover solid residue, the spent material.
It's a sobering thought, isn't it? Most exposures probably happen because of, well, mistakes. Preventable ones.
Sadly, yes. It could be something like forgetting or just neglecting to put up warning signs around the treated area.
Crucial.
Or failing to monitor the gas levels with the proper equipment. Not using the right personal protective equipment, the PPE.
Or maybe using it incorrectly.
Exactly. Like using a respirator that doesn't fit properly, doesn't seal to the face. Or just not maintaining that safe equipment, letting it fall into disrepair.
And the symptoms. What should people be aware of?
They can range quite a bit. Mild symptoms might be things like fatigue, maybe nausea, some irritation in the lungs.
Right.
But it can get severe very quickly. Difficulty breathing, agitation, confusion, even rapid death.
Wow.
And what's particularly worrying are the potential delayed effects.
Delayed? Like how long after?
Hours, sometimes even days after the exposure. Things like cardiovascular problems, heart issues, liver or kidney failure, or pulmonary edema fluid buildup in the lungs.
That's terrifying. So even if you feel okay initially?
You need immediate medical attention, absolutely. Even if there are no obvious symptoms right after you think you might have been exposed, don't wait.
And you need to tell the doctors what you were exposed to, right?
Yeah.
Critically important, have the product information ready. The EPA registration number, the safety data sheet, the SDS, give that to the medical team.
Good advice.
And everyone should know this number, really. The Poison Control Center. It's 1-800-222-2222, available 24/7.
Okay, 1-800-222-2222. Got it.
Yeah.
Given all these profound dangers we've just laid out, it's really no surprise the government steps in pretty heavily.
Mm-hmm. Regulation is key.
And in California, this isn't just general rules. It's a really specific, quite intricate system of control.
It is.
Aluminum and magnesium phosphide, they're classified as restricted materials. So what does that mean practically?
Practically, it means you, the applicator or property owner, you absolutely need a restricted materials permit just to possess or use these things.
And who issues that permit?
Your local county agricultural commissioner, the SAIC. You have to go through them.
And I imagine getting that permit isn't just filling out a form.
Oh, no, it's quite a thorough process.
Yeah.
The property operator has to identify all known sensitive sites nearby.
Sensitive sites?
Like obvious ones like hospitals, schools, daycare centers, but also residential areas, labor camps, parks, any nearby waterways, and significantly, wildlife management areas or refuges.
Okay.
And the applicant has to show they've thought about it, considered, and adopted mitigation measures to lessen any potential significant harm to the environment.
So you have to plan ahead for safety.
You do. And what's more, the TASE, the county commissioners, they actually have the authority to impose their own local permit conditions.
Wait, so conditions beyond what's on the product label?
Exactly. They can make the rules even stricter than the label itself based on local conditions or concerns.
And those local rules are legally binding?
Absolutely. You have to follow both the label and any stricter county permit conditions.
Oh, okay. So that label... It sounds incredibly important. You mentioned it's the law.
It is the law. And it's not just the sticker on the container. It includes the comprehensive applicator's manual that comes with the product. That whole packet is legally binding.
So let's break down some key parts of that label. What should people look for?
Okay, first off, the signal word. For these phosphide fumigants, it will always be danger poison. Big letters.
Danger poison. Hard to miss.
And usually accompanied by the skull and crossbone symbol. This designates it as a toxicity category. I pesticide, the highest hazard level there is.
Okay, highest risk. What else?
The directions for use section. This is the core of it. It tells you exactly how to apply it, including precise dosage rates, you know, how many tablets or pellets per burrow system.
Gotta get the dose right.
Critically, this section also details the required PPE, especially the specific type of respirator needed for different situations, and it includes vital notification requirements who you need to tell before you start, like authorities or workers on site.
Right. Then there are environmental warnings.
Yes, the environmental hazards section. It'll state very clearly that the product is toxic to fish and wildlife, non-target animals, and strict instructions to avoid contaminating water sources.
Makes sense. Storage and transport.
Huge section, storage and transportation, requires keeping these products in a dry, locked, well-ventilated area. never near food, feed, or where humans or domestic animals live.
Locked up tight.
And you usually need to post NFPA placards, those diamond-shaped hazard signs on the storage area. Plus, there are specific Department of Transportation, DOT, regulations for transporting hazardous materials like these.
Okay, and what about spills? Accidents happen.
The spill and leak procedure section is vital here. And the absolute number one rule, never use water on a metal phosphide spill.
Why not? Seems counterintuitive.
Because water reacts violently with it. It dramatically accelerates the production of phosphine gas. You'd create a huge fire hazard and a massive toxic gas cloud instantly.
Wow. We're getting no water. What do you do instead?
The label will give instructions, often involving careful containment with dry sand or soil, and provide emergency contacts. Like Chemtrac, the Chemical Transportation Emergency Center, their number is 800-424-9300.
Good number to have. 800-424-9300. And disposal. What about leftover stuff?
Disposal instructions are very specific. They detail how to handle the partially reacted residue, sometimes called green dust, from aluminum phosphide, and how to deal with the empty containers, which are usually non-refillable.
And that dust? Still dangerous.
Potentially, yes. It might still react. The label specifically warns never to store spent dust in a confined space, like a sealed drum or indoors. Again, because of that lingering fire risk.
Right, the spontaneous ignition thing. Okay, beyond the immediate human safety, there's another huge piece here. Protecting the environment, right? The non-target species.
Absolutely crucial. Because phosphine gas, it doesn't discriminate. It's highly toxic to all wildlife, not just the ground squirrel or gopher you're after.
So you really need to know what's down that hole before you treat it.
Exactly. Diligent pre-application assessment is non-negotiable.
And California has specific programs for this.
Yes. The Department of Pesticide Regulation, DPR, has an endangered species project. They map sensitive habitats and develop specific protection strategies.
So applicators need to check something before they start.
They are required to. They have to consult resources to find out if there are geographically specific use limitations for their exact location. Tools like the EPA's Bulletins Live 2 website or DPR's own prescribed database.
So you look up your specific field or area.
Precisely. To see if there are endangered species concerns. A classic example is the San Joaquin kit fox.
Ah, the kit fox.
Yeah, it's an endangered species. And guess what? It often uses ground squirrel burrows.
Oh, boy.
So mistaking an active kit fox den for a squirrel burrow, that's not just a mistake. It could be a violation of the Endangered Species Act and devastating for that animal.
So that brings us to the actual pre-fumigation inspection. Before you even think about opening a container, what are you actually looking for?
You're gathering intelligence, really, trying to figure out who's living there, target pest or non-target animal. Is the area even suitable for fumigation? What's the soil like? What are the weather conditions?
How do you tell if a burrow is even active?
You look for signs, fresh digging, recent droppings or scat near the entrance, maybe tracks. Inactive burrows might have cobwebs over the opening or old weathered scat.
But burrows can be shared, right? Or taken over by something else.
Absolutely. Which leads to the really critical question. How do you confirm the target pest is actually the current resident and not something else, maybe something protected?
Tricky.
There are methods. We mentioned the soil ball test earlier, squeezing some soil in your hand. If it holds its shape, it's moist enough, which helps contain the gas.
Okay.
You can also try plugging burrow entrances lightly with soil or grass. Come back a day or two later. If they're reopened, something's actively using it.
Oh, neat trick.
And knowing typical burrow sizes helps too. Ground squirrels, generally 2 to 4 inch openings. Pocket gophers, maybe 3 to 4 inches, often with that characteristic mound. Mm-hmm. If you see a burrow that looks way different, bigger or smaller, that's a red flag. Pause and investigate. Don't just assume.
Okay, good indicators. All right, let's shift to the actual application. We hammered home that odor isn't reliable. So, the gas detectors.
Non-negotiable. They are the only reliable way to measure phosphine levels in the air. Full stop. Relying on your nose is just asking for trouble.
And there are specific levels that trigger actions.
Yes. The regulations define trigger levels. These are specific air concentrations measured in parts per million, PPM, that require you to take action.
Like what?
Like putting on a respirator, or if the levels are too high, immediately leaving the work area. The exact numbers aren't the main takeaway for everyone listening, but the principle is you measure, you know the level, and you follow the rules precisely based on that reading.
So different levels might require different gear.
Exactly. If the levels are unknown or measured above a certain high threshold, say 15 ppm, you need the highest level of protection. A NIOH-approved self-contained breathing apparatus, an SCBA, like firefighters wear.
Okay, serious gear.
If it's lower, say between 0.3 and 15 ppm, you typically need a NIOH-approved full-face canister respirator with the correct cartridge for phosphine.
Still full-face protection.
Yes. Only when levels are confirmed below that lower threshold, like 0.3 ppm, is no respiratory protection required by the label.
And just to be crystal clear, those dust masks people wear, like N95s.
Useless. Absolutely useless against fumigant gases. They filter particles, not gases. Using one would give a completely false sense of security. Very dangerous.
Got it. No N95s for fumigants. Now, speaking of PPE, you mentioned something really unique, almost counterintuitive, about gloves.
Ah, yes, the gloves. Instead of the typical chemical-resistant gloves you'd expect with pesticides.
Right, like nitrile or neoprene.
The labels for phosphides often instruct you to wear dry cotton or leather gloves.
Cotton. Why on earth?
Because moisture from your skin, your sweat, can actually start activating the fumigant right on your hands. If you wore waterproof gloves, that phosphine gas could get tracked against your skin.
Oh, wow. And cause burns.
Severe chemical burns, yes. Cotton gloves, being breathable, allow some airflow and reduce the chance of that gas buildup right against the skin.
Fascinating. And weirdly logical when you explain it, and beyond gloves and respirator.
There's the whole respiratory protection program that employers must have in place if respirators are required.
What does that involve?
It's quite comprehensive. A medical evaluation to make sure the employee is physically okay to wear a respirator.
Okay.
Fit testing, making sure the specific make and model of respirator fits that individual person correctly and creates a proper seal.
No leaks.
No leaks. And that means, sorry folks, no beards or heavy sideburns that interfere with the seal. Clean shaven is usually required.
Practicalities.
And annual training, making sure everyone knows how to use, inspect, maintain, and store their respirator correctly and understands the hazards. It really drives home how seriously this is taken.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
Because you've got your gear, you've done your inspection. What about the conditions during application? You mentioned soil moisture being important.
Crucial. Moist soil does two things. It helps activate the fumigant. Remember, it needs moisture to release the gas.
Right.
And maybe more importantly, it helps contain the gas within the burrow system. Dry, porous soil lets the gas escape too easily.
And that soil ball test helps check that.
Exactly. Grab a handful of soil, squeeze it. If it holds its shape, it's probably moist enough. If it crumbles, conditions might not be ideal for fumigation.
And this links back to pest biology too, right?
Right.
Timing matters.
Definitely. Like with ground squirrels, you generally want to avoid fumigating when they're hibernating in winter or estivating. That's like summer hibernation in hot, dry periods.
Why is that?
Because they often plug their burrows tightly with soil during those times. The gas simply can't reach them if the entrance is blocked.
So you'd waste the product.
Waste the product, waste your time, and achieve nothing. And dosage rates, again, follow that label strictly. Never use more than allowed that's illegal and unsafe.
And don't use too little either.
Right. Under-applying might not kill the pests effectively, leading to only partial control and potentially contributing to resistance down the line.
And the actual method varies, open versus closed burrows.
Yeah, the technique might differ slightly. Ground squirrels tend to have more open, interconnected systems. Pocket gophers have those characteristic closed systems where you need to probe to find the main tunnel. The label usually specifies.
Okay, so we've hit safety, regulations, equipment conditions.
Yeah.
But underpinning all of this is knowing what pest you're actually dealing with.
Absolutely fundamental.
Pest identification. This isn't just, you know, academic curiosity. It directly drives your control strategy.
100%. Because if you mistake, say, a mole for a gopher.
Which people do.
All the time. But they're totally different animals. Moles aren't even rodents. They eat insects and worms. Your fumigation strategy for a gopher might be completely wrong, totally ineffective for a mole. You'd waste time, money, product, and potentially harm non-targets.
So let's quickly run through the key burrowing pests covered in the manual that people might encounter in California. Ground squirrels.
Yeah, you might see California ground squirrels or Belding's ground squirrels. They're social. They live in colonies, often visible above ground. Their burrows are pretty open systems, and they cause huge damage to crops, irrigation levees, even building foundations.
Okay. Pocket gophers.
The masters of digging. Right. Rarely seen above ground. You know them by their mounds, those characteristic crescent-shaped piles of soil with a plugged hole off to one side. Closed burrow systems.
Voles. sometimes called meadow mice.
Right. Often confused with house mice, but voles have shorter tails, smaller ears, look for their shallow burrows, and, importantly, their surface runways through the grass, often littered with droppings or scat.
Okay. Rats. We talking field rats?
Primarily Norway rats and roof rats in agricultural or landscape settings. Norway rats are stockier, blunt snout, tail shorter than the body. Roof rats are more slender, pointy nose, tail longer than the body, and they're excellent climbers. Both cause massive economic damage, especially ruining stored feed or crops.
Moles.
You said they're different.
Totally different order of mammal. Insectivores, not rodents, key identifier. Those huge paddle-shaped front paws with six fingers or projections built for digging. And their mounds are distinct too, usually volcano-shaped, conical, without an obvious entrance or exit hole like a gopher mound.
Six fingers, volcano mounds.
Got it.
Anything else?
Chipmunks. A very important point the manual makes. Aluminum phosphide products are not labeled or registered for chipmunk control in California.
So you cannot legally use it on chipmunks there?
Correct. Using it would be an illegal off-label application.
Okay, that's a critical distinction. So weighing it all up, let's talk disadvantages of fumigation. It sounds effective, but what are the downsides?
Well, cost can be one. Some estimates suggest it can be 5, maybe even 10 times more expensive in terms of labor and product cost compared to using certain rodenticide baits for the same area.
That's significant.
It is. Also, as we've said, it's not pest specific. It kills any animal inside that burrow when you treat it. Target, non-target, endangered species. Anything breathing in there is at risk.
High stakes.
Very. Fumigation is also generally less effective in really rocky soils or very dry, sandy soils. The gas just leaks out too easily.
Right, a containment issue.
Exactly. And finally, there's no residual effect. Once the phosphine gas dissipates, which happens relatively quickly, the burrow is safe again. This means new pests from neighboring areas can move in and reinfest pretty quickly.
So it's not a long-term solution on its own?
Not usually, no. It requires ongoing monitoring.
But there must be advantages too, otherwise people wouldn't use it.
Oh, absolutely. It's relatively easy to use in some ways. No need for pre-baiting, like with some rodenticides where you have to get the pests used to eating the bait first.
Okay, faster maybe.
Can be. And a big one. No need for carcass removal. With baits, you often have dead rodents potentially surfacing, which can be an issue. Fumigation usually handles that underground.
Less cleanup.
And from an environmental standpoint, a key advantage is the low residual toxicity. Once the phosphine gas breaks down, it doesn't linger in the environment or build up in the food chain like some rodenticides can.
So less risk to predators eating the dead pest.
Much lower risk of that secondary exposure for predators like hawks, owls, or coyotes compared to some bait products. That's a significant ecological benefit.
That is a big plus.
And finally, these products generally work across a wide range of temperatures, which gives applicators a broader window for use during the year compared to some other methods that might be more temperature sensitive.
Okay, a complex picture with clear pros and cons.
Definitely.
And there you have it. That was our deep dive into the really fascinating, definitely intricate, and clearly high-stakes world of burrowing vertebrate pest fumigation.
We covered a lot of ground.
We really did. From understanding this highly toxic, invisible gas, to navigating those complex California regulations, and getting into the very specific techniques for application, It just highlights, I think, the immense value of really detailed knowledge and super meticulous planning in this field.
It really does. And if we try to connect this to the bigger picture, While this manual, the source material, is laser focused on the safe and legal application of these specific fumigants.
Right, the how-to.
It's always crucial to remember those core principles of integrated pest management, IPM.
Good point. Where does fumigation fit into IPM?
Well, fumigation is undoubtedly a powerful tool, no question. But it's just one tool in the toolbox. It's only one part of a potentially multifaceted approach to pest control.
So it shouldn't be the default?
Ideally not. You should always be asking, is this the most necessary option right now? Is it the most appropriate choice for this specific situation, considering everything else?
Including the risks.
Including all the risks and the potential impact on all forms of life in that environment, not just the target pest. It requires careful consideration.
A thoughtful approach. Well, thank you for joining us on another deep dive.
My pleasure.
So what does all this mean for you listening? It means you now have a shortcut, hopefully, to being incredibly well-informed about this highly regulated, often unseen world that really does impact our agriculture and our environment. Mm-hmm. And maybe, just maybe, you've gained a new appreciation for the kind of critical thinking, the meticulous planning that's required when managing these really complex challenges.
Hope so.
So here's something to maybe mull over. Think about how applying this level of specific detail, this kind of thoughtful step-by-step planning we've discussed from this very specific context.
Yeah.
How could that translate to other areas of your life? Where might a similarly rigorous, detail-oriented approach lead to surprising insights or maybe just better outcomes for you? Something to think about.